Lecture 18, Jean-Paul Sartre at War.
Jean-Paul Sartre is the ultimate existentialist. He named the movement, and when people talk about existentialism, it's typically his philosophy they have in mind. The characteristics that I've mentioned previously, the emphasis on freedom and choice, and responsibility in particular, are very much the centerpieces of his philosophy, and as I pointed out with some of the members of the movement, Nietzsche for example, they aren't particularly central, and with someone like Heidegger, they're also problematic. Sartre's existentialism really does focus on one concept above all else, and that is the concept of responsibility. Perhaps the only person who followed him through and considered herself an existentialist along with him was his equally remarkable lifelong partner, Simone de Beauvoir, and of their relationship I'm going to have something to say a bit later on. Sartre wrote voluminously. In fact, it's said that he wrote as much as 20 pages a day, every day of his life, and he lived into his 70s. But the idea is that what he wrote was so varied and so, in a way, all over the place that to talk about Sartre's philosophy is really just to talk about a piece of a very grand campaign. He wrote literature. Some of it I would consider excellent. He wrote a great many journal articles, magazine pieces, and of course newspaper pieces throughout his life. He was very deeply politically engaged, and perhaps he is best known among writers for his defense of what he called engaged literature, which would include philosophy. The idea is that philosophy must be nothing if not practical, and that meant for him political. One doesn't write for the enjoyment of it, one doesn't write for the prestige, one doesn't write for the external rewards. And as evidence of this, when he received the Nobel Prize in 1964, he rather dramatically turned it down. Sartre's writings in politics are very often, I think, eccentric. But his writings in philosophy, I think, deserve to be recognized as some of the greatest in the 20th century. He follows very closely on Martin Heidegger, and you'll see there's a good deal of influence there. But unlike Heidegger, who was often a bit vague on such notions as freedom and responsibility, Sartre is absolutely straightforward. It is from him that I essentially take the notion, no excuses, the idea that one is always responsible, one cannot beg off, one cannot push the blame on someone else, but one is always responsible for what one does, who one is, and perhaps more problematically, for the state of the world. Much of Sartre's writing, and in particular his great book, Being in Nothingness, which will form the core of most of what I'll be saying, was written during the German occupation. In fact, Sartre was in prison camp for a short time. One should carefully distinguish this from the horror of the German concentration camps. He had access to literature, he had access to books and writing materials, and consequently, it's really from his place in the German camp that he begins the ideas and the writing of Being in Nothingness. We have a rather full set of letters between himself and Simone, and I will say, despite the rather coldness of some of Sartre's writings, in those letters at least, he shows himself to be a warm, caring human being. But anyway, it's during the German occupation that he writes this, and it's the occupation itself which gives Sartre really the impetus for his basic thesis. There's an irony perhaps here, and that is that he borrows in his language and in his ideas very heavily, not only from Heidegger, but from other German philosophers as well. But his target really is not the Germans. The target is his fellow Frenchmen. He denounced them for their cowardice, for their hypocrisy, for their collaboration. And much of this, of course, is becoming evident only really in the last 10 years as some of the files are opened up and we can see how the average Frenchman really did behave during the war. Sartre was particularly bothered by the disclaimers and the excuses that people made about why they did what they did, why they didn't, for example, join that movement called the Resistance, the French underground, which was trying to undermine the German occupation, or why people actually collaborated and pursued their careers, perhaps to their own advantage, but very often to to the clear disadvantage of the French community. In general, the idea of excuses must have weighed very heavily on him. What's more, it's an excellent test for an age-old philosophical question. That is, what is human nature? Now, if you go into some aspects of philosophy, that question gets answered in a very armchair sort of way. We imagine human beings before the advent of society. We imagine human beings in the so-called state of nature. And then we kind of make up, on the basis of our casual experience, what people must have been like. And one set of theories says people are basically selfish and not very nice to each other. Another set of theories says that basically people are basically content and sort of indifferent to one another, that it's society that causes them to have the traits that they have. And another theory yet might be that people in the state of nature really are already looking for recognition from others. But this is armchair philosophy, and it has very little to back it up, except for one's rather casual experiences of people in ordinary life. In recent Oxford philosophy, analyses of human nature often take the form of people keeping promises and what people do as good citizens of a civilized state. But suppose you take the question of human nature in a different way. Suppose you think that human nature betrays itself not in everyday behavior, but rather it's something that you have to discover only by putting human beings under stress. You take the analogy from chemistry. If you have a bit of stuff that you want to analyze, you don't just look at it, but what you do is you see what happens if you subject it to enormous pressure, or heat it to a boiling point, or treat it with acid, or a strong base, or perhaps bombard it with neutrons, or put it in liquid nitrogen and see what it does. In other words, by putting it under enormous stress, what you discover is what it really is. And Sartre has this view, which he shares, by the way, with Camus, which, if you want to understand human nature, you can't just sort of look at people in their daily bourgeois existence, but rather you have to look at people under the greatest stress. And perhaps there's no greater stress than being occupied by an army during the midst of one of the most horrible wars in the history of humanity. So what he saw as he watched his fellow citizens and as he dealt with them in his own minor role in the resistance was that people would do what they did, collaborate, or in any case, cooperate. And what they said about what they did almost always came out in terms of excuses. For example, what can I do? The kind of excuse from impotence. The idea is that the forces of history and the German army is so overwhelmingly powerful. And here I am, one lone individual, perhaps even without arms. What could I possibly do? Or there's the argument from innocence. I didn't start the war. The idea of innocence here is one that we've run across in Camus, who at this time is very much a colleague of Sartre. It's a notion that we've run across in perhaps other philosophers too, and notably, for example, in Heidegger, who in a very different sense talks about innocent guilt. But with Sartre, the idea of innocence takes on a rather striking notion because it's not the abstract metaphysical notion that you get, for example, in Heidegger. And it's not the very generalized kind of notion of original sin that you get in Camus. But rather, it's a notion of innocence which has to do with making excuses. One begs off by saying, I'm not responsible, therefore. There's the notion of everyone else is doing it, the appeal to a kind of herd instinct, going back to Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. The idea that everyone else was collaborating, the idea that one's friends were not doing anything to aid the resistance, that in itself seemed to be an adequate excuse for a great many people. And of course, we hear it today in all sorts of contexts. For example, people in business who say, well, I really know this is wrong, but everyone else is doing it. It's another excuse, and it's just the kind of excuse that Sartre wants to get rid of. There's the I'm just looking out for me excuse, the appeal to self-preservation, the idea that each of us, in a sense, is a selfish or at any rate self-interested being, and so what I'm doing is just natural. It's what anyone would do in a similar situation, and if they're not, then that's their problem. There is the I had no choice excuse, the appeal to helplessness, the idea that we all really didn't have any alternatives. I mean, here we are, we're stuck in Paris, the Germans are all around us, and so what we have to think about is simply what we have to do. But the emphasis is on have to do. We don't have choices. And finally, there's a kind of emotional appeal, the idea of I was afraid. So I collaborated because I was afraid what would happen to me or what would happen to my family if I didn't. Or I didn't cooperate with the resistance because I was afraid of what the Gestapo would do if they caught us, and so on. To all these excuses, Sartre wants to say, no. The central thesis of his philosophy, put in one way, is we are absolutely free. And that means that we don't have excuses, that we are responsible for what we do. But before I go any further, let me just put aside one very common misunderstanding and criticism of Sartre's philosophy. Philosophers very often will take someone with whom they have problems, and Sartre gives us lots of problems to cope with. For example, he's always throwing responsibility back in our faces. And this causes lots of philosophers to resist him. In fact, one of these philosophers was Martin Heidegger, but that story more later. But what we get with Sartre is the idea that we are absolutely free, not in the sense, the absurd sense, that we can do anything, or we can do anything that we choose to do. But rather, it's the idea that we always have choices. And what is dramatic about Sartre's philosophy, and what makes it so challenging and appealing, is the way he extends this thesis into all sorts of realms of human life and shows us that we have choices in many ways that we never considered ourselves to have choices before. To interpret the notion of absolute freedom, I would suggest something like the notion of the absence of any ultimate constraints. Sartre makes it very clear that we are always, in some sense, constrained by our situation. We are always given a limited number of choices in one sense. There's the idea that we are never free from our circumstances, and of course, as Heidegger says, and Sartre uses this language, we are thrown into our world in a particular place, at a particular time, in a particular political situation, and so on. And within those circumstances, we often don't have a very wide range of choices. But nevertheless, we always have choices. And the important thing about Sartre's philosophy is to appreciate just what those choices are and how we are responsible even in the most minimal situations. Let me give you an example. There is a scene that's very popular in French literature as illustrating just this thesis. We saw it in Camus' novel, The Stranger, and it's the idea of throwing a young man in prison and, in that sense, absolutely limiting his freedom in one sense, but using it as a device to show just how much freedom we really have. In prison, Merceau learns about freedom of thought, the freedom to reflect. So he reflects on the possibility that he might have a 1 in a million chance of escaping rather than facing the certainty of execution. He reflects on the meaning of his crime, his imprisonment. He reflects on the overall meaning of his life and tries to ascertain what that is. He thinks about the execution, and he comes up with the conclusion that he really has choices regarding the execution itself, namely how to face it. Let me take an even more extreme example. There's a cartoon that's been popular for quite a few years called The Wizard of Id, which contains a character called the Spook, who is a man thrown in prison, presumably for a very, very long time. The Spook is not only in the dungeon of this medieval situation, but he's also shackled to the wall. So he's spread-eagled, he can't hardly move. And the question is, does it make any sense whatsoever to talk about him as free? Well, Sartre would say, yes indeed. He has a number of choices. He can see himself as rightly condemned, and consequently spend his life feeling penance. He can see himself as wrongly condemned and spend his life feeling resentment. He can resolve to be a martyr for whatever cause it is that he might choose to be a martyr for. He might choose to be an example of an exemplary prisoner, or perhaps the example of a terrible prisoner. He can rail and shout, make himself utterly obnoxious, even if no one will hear him. He can try to escape, perhaps absurdly, by simply trying with his fingernails to sort of carve his way through the iron of the shackles. It probably wouldn't work. But this highlights what Sartre has in mind by absolute freedom. It's not the freedom to accomplish, to achieve anything we choose, but it's always the freedom to try. And the freedom, first of all, to form our attitudes and the sense in which we will approach and deal with the world. He gives an example of a mountain. And in a sense, a mountain is just a fact of nature. It's there. And yet, people who live near the mountain have all sorts of choices, which they probably make collectively. For example, they can choose to see the mountain as a sacred object, as the center of their universe. They can choose to see the mountain as an obstacle, something that blocks their easy progress to get to the other side. They could choose to see the mountain as an aesthetic wonder, something beautiful to look at. They could see the mountain as protection from dangers on the other side. Of course, they could adopt several of these attitudes more or less at once. But the idea is that the options, the alternatives, the different ways we can deal with the world are always open to us. And even though the situation might seriously limit what those options might be, there are always options. So Sartre says, extremely harshly, we all get the war we deserve. Because one imagines being caught in the middle of the Second World War during the German occupation. And one can see in Sartre's fellow countrymen the different kinds of choices that they made. One looks at the war as a source of profit. One thinks of Cotard in Camus' novel, The Plague. Another looks at the war as a great misfortune. Still another looks at the war as an opportunity to pursue journalism, to write a great novel. Or the same character might think the war is a good time to simply lay low and disappear from society. And so one hides in the basement for 5, 6, 7 years. One, of course, might see the war as an opportunity for heroism. Or one might see the war as a source of great obligation. And one could go on at some length. But the idea is that even this horrible situation, which in one sense wasn't chosen by anyone, at least not by any ordinary person, nevertheless presents us not with a choiceless situation, but rather precisely a situation which requires, which demands, any number of choices. And that's the idea. That we have a choice here about how we're to live our lives, what we're to make of ourselves, even in the direst and the most constricting of situations. Towards the end of his life, in an interview, Sartre says, one is always responsible for what one makes of what is made of one. It's a bit convoluted, but when you think about it, it makes perfectly good sense. We don't choose our situations. In an important sense, we don't even choose ourselves. Namely, we're subject to all sorts of forces, starting from the circumstances of our birth and our background and our upbringing and peer pressure and our jobs and our world. Nevertheless, within those circumstances, we are responsible for making the choices, which include, among other things, the choices which will change the circumstances and allow us to make something else of ourselves in the future. And this is really the heart of what Sartre's trying to tell us. There's a sense in which one is often tempted to say that the constraints on human freedom are not necessarily those that are external. For example, the threat of German soldiers or the threat of some sort of external sanctions. But the threats against our freedom are often from the inside. For example, in compulsion, the sense that we have to do something and we can't escape that impulse. Or the idea of strong desire, or perhaps most dramatically, the intrusion of strong emotions. Sartre's thesis here at first is going to sound a bit confusing and counterintuitive. But to summarize it very quickly, it is not that one is caused to behave by his or her emotions or motives, but rather, emotions and motives are really part of the situation in which one chooses what to do. In particular, let me focus on emotions for a minute, because that is going to be, as you'll see, an essential part of Sartre's argument. We often say, I couldn't help it, I was just afraid. Or I didn't mean what I said, I was just very angry. Or I'm sorry I was so foolish, I was falling in love. And what's dramatic here is that in each and every case, emotions are being used as excuses. We did something, and now we want to take away our responsibility for doing it, and instead blame it on the emotion. Once again, we have this picture of emotion as something inside us, but at the same time foreign, a kind of intrusion on our rationality, the Freudian it, if you like. But thinking about it, we realize something very different is the case. Take anger. We say, I didn't really mean it. I was just very angry. But the friend whom you insulted knows, and you know yourself, that what you said was not just the product of anger, but it was in fact a very deep, cutting insight that perhaps you had sort of thought of for a very long time but never said before. The fact that you were in truth telling something much closer to the way you really feel than you have in perhaps months or years of casual friendship. Instead of the anger talking and contradicting your own preferences and choices, there's a sense in which the anger itself is a choice. One thinks about how one gets angry, and we talk about this as if it's something that just hits us. And it's true, sometimes the circumstances that make us angry happen very suddenly. But when we get angry, what we do is we make a decision. There might be that first flush as you recognize that you have been gravely offended. But then you have to decide, and often we do this very quickly, what can we do about it? What should we do about it? And you decide at that point whether to forget it or whether to dwell on it, whether to say something back, increasing the odds of increased hostility, or whether to just keep your mouth shut. Let me take the example of love, because perhaps that's the most dramatic. We talk about falling in love. Is there, in fact, such a thing? Well, I believe in love at first sight, and I do believe that you meet people who are just almost chemically dazzling to you. There is a sense in which you meet someone, get very excited, but is that the same thing as falling in love? I think not at all. It's not even infatuation. It's just being excited. Then you have to make a choice. You make a choice, for example, whether or not to continue to look at this person, whether or not to talk to the person. Later on, you have to decide whether or not to date the person, whether or not to marry the person. And in short, when you think about falling in love, it's actually a gradual, or sometimes a rather quick, step-by-step process which involves choices every bit of the way. Put this together, and one comes away with the conclusion that emotions are not simply things that happen to us. They're not excuses, such as the train got derailed. But rather, they are choices that we make in a very subtle way, which very strongly influence both the way we see the world and the way we act. And that, of course, is precisely what Sartre is after. This emphasis on choice as opposed to things happening to us extends to other realms as well. For example, consider someone who is shy. Now, the way we generally think about shyness, like most character traits, is it's something like a structure of the personality. And the structure of the personality causes us to behave in certain ways, to perform certain acts. What Sartre suggests is that the causal relationship, if we want to talk about a causal relationship, goes just the other way. That in fact, we are shy because we engage in certain behaviors, because we act in certain ways. This is perhaps most important in the context of the situation he faced in the war, looking at his fellow countrymen and their reactions to the Germans, and also in one of his best plays, a play called No Exit, which I'll talk about in a few lectures. And that's the question about cowardice. Because people are often quite happy to make an excuse for themselves and say, well, I didn't do something, or I won't do something, because I'm a coward. And the picture is, here's this structure of one's personality causing us to make certain choices, causing us to perform certain actions. Sartre would say just the opposite. You are a coward because you choose to behave in certain ways. And once again, The whole emphasis gets turned around. Instead of talking about what we are forced to do, or what we have to do, or what we are determined to do, what Sartre puts the emphasis on is the choices that we have within the situation. It's in this sense that we're all responsible, in fact, for the world. When he says we all get the war we deserve, he's referring, of course, not just to that particular circumstance and the different options that one can choose with regard to the war. He's also talking about the consequences of those choices, and he's talking more generally about the kinds of choices we have all the time. Now, a very important point here, which I'll later bury in some fairly heavy Teutonic terminology, but that is, the choices we make are not always self-evident to us. We think of choice very often as something which is essentially deliberate and reflective, as when, for example, you're talking with a friend about which restaurant you'll go to tonight, and you give the different possibilities, and you weigh the options, and you think of the prices, and you talk about it, and you think about it, and the decision in some way emerges from the discussion. But we make other kinds of choices too. In fact, we're making choices all the time, not only in behaviors which Sartre will call unreflective or pre-reflective, behaviors in which we aren't reflecting as such. We just kind of see that something must be done and we choose to do it. But perhaps more importantly, we also behave in those ways when there are all sorts of choices which we never think of. And this is absolutely essential to Sartre's philosophy, as you'll see, because it's an essential part of the political wing of the no excuses issue. Consider, for example, as I say to my classes, the number of things that you could be doing right now instead of being in this class. Some of them, of course, not particularly productive, drinking coffee in the local student cafe, but others. Could you at this point be helping the Red Cross, or serving the homeless downtown, or doing any of a number of other things that you might all think of that would really benefit humanity in a major way? This is not to say you should do it, but it's to say you could be doing it. And according to Sartre, it is also to say you are responsible for not doing it. There's a sense in which what we're doing all the time is making choices to do what we're doing to the exclusion of all sorts of other alternatives which you simply choose not to think about. Now, there's some serious questions that come in here, and Sartre's colleague Maurice Merleau-Ponty raised some of them in his continuing conversations with Sartre, as well as in some of his own books. Is it really fair to people to charge them with responsibility for situations of which they are utterly ignorant? One thinks about the problems that missionaries sometimes face when they are dealing with overseas tribes, people who have never heard of Jesus Christ, and they face the rather awful thesis that despite the fact that these people have never heard of Christ, nevertheless, they are responsible for not taking him in. Well, it's a similar thesis here. What do we say about children who are too young to understand what's going on? What do we say about a peasant in some far-flung country who doesn't have any news, doesn't know how other people live, doesn't know the options that are readily available to us? Well, perhaps we want to modify the thesis in certain ways. But let me simply emphasize what's most important to Sartre. If he's to say we are responsible for the world and the state of the world, then it must be the case that we are not just responsible for those choices which we make deliberately and reflectively, but we're responsible for all sorts of choices that we make, in a sense, out of default or out of neglect, which we don't think about, but which we are capable of thinking about and perhaps should think about. The idea, as always, is no excuses. The fact that you didn't think of it is no excuse. The fact that it is inconvenient or has a great cost is no excuse. As always, what you choose is not just the act, but its consequences. And what you choose, therefore, is the cost. And if you say it's too expensive, it's too inconvenient, it's too difficult, then you're responsible for making that choice too. The idea is you're responsible for yourself and you're responsible for the world. And what I'd like to do in the subsequent lectures is try to make that thesis as plausible as possible.